From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Today we have a guest analyst. Christina Bellantoni is joining us. She's the assistant managing editor for politics with the LA Times. Of course, her name may be familiar because she used to be a guest host on this broadcast, or because she was the editor-in-chief with CQ Roll Call. Christina, good to see you.
Great to see you. Miss you guys.
Also in studio with us is Anthony Brown. He is Maryland's former lieutenant governor. He won the Democratic primary for Maryland's 4th congressional district earlier this week. Anthony Brown, welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be on the program today.
As usual, we're going to start out by discussing some other issues. Tom Sherwood, it's my understanding that you want to ask Christina Bellantoni about something?
Yeah, I do. Virginia State Senator Richard Black, Loudoun County, right? I think it is. He's in Syria.
Yeah.
Greeting President Assad with a handshake while Assad's government is bombing a hospital in Syria's largest city. What's that all about?
You know, I used to cover Dick Black many, many years ago. He was the first lawmaker I met when I came to cover the Virginia State House in 2003, and he is a strange person, I will just say. He has made social issues his crusade as a lawmaker, and somehow his
passed
name...
passed out plastic fetuses.
He did, in fact. And somehow he's always... his name is always on something like this. So I hadn't seen this headline before arriving this morning, but it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. He manages to insert himself in national issues and really just stick it to whoever the Democratic leaders are. I mean, he goes after Nancy Pelosi. He's gone after President Obama since he's been in office, and he doesn't go away. And Bob Marshall, he and Dick Black were like hand in hand. Another guy who always turns up in Virginia politics.
What about Senator Black's position that he was essentially thanking President Assad for protecting the persecuted Christians?
I mean, it's a political mess, effectively. So I just think, you know, when you're a state politician wading into something like this, like
wading into a very
White House,
you just wonder
international
why.
Situation. Well, the White House, you know, one of the Obama's not been figured out, hasn't figured out how to get rid of Assad, but he's, you know, the White House calls Assad the brutal dictator, and I just thought it was remarkable that we show up in Syria to pal around with the head of that country.
Anthony Brown, if you are elected to the Congress of the United States later this year, foreign policy is one of the things you'll have to deal with. You actually served in Iraq at one point, so you're familiar with that part of the world. But I suspect you won't be jetting off to Syria to shake hands with President Assad anytime soon.
No, I won't be doing that. And look, for the last 16 years, I've focused most of my time and attention very locally in Maryland. So I'm not afraid to acknowledge I've got a steep learning curve on the ins and outs, the nuances, and the details of foreign policy issues.
But well, I won't like be everyone else, you do have to have an opinion on Metro Secretary, Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox says safety should be its priority. So on Thursday, he replaced three members of the transit agency's board, those who are appointed by the federal government. He replaced them with transportation safety professionals. He said that should be the emphasis here. And Senator and Congressman John Delaney from Maryland is introducing a bill to the House that would force the three jurisdictions, Maryland, Virginia, and the district, to do the same when they appoint experts, when they appoint representatives to Metro. They want them to have all safety experts. Tom Sherwood.
Well, the Congress and the administration has done everything but do what it should do, which is put up money from the federal government to help fund the operation of the Metro system that gets federal workers
that's
to their
board
job.
Chairman Jack Evans is saying.
Which, well, that's right. He can't be here today because he would take up the whole hour, so I would just summarize his position. But as a citizen of the city, it's also mine. You see, it's fine if they want to have expertise on the Metro board, but helping the board fund itself would also be good.
you know, the metro system, when the big shutdown happened and they ended up having to call a federal government holiday, I was watching this from L.A. and I just thought, you know, will there ever be a tipping point where federal officials address the need to have better infrastructure? You know, it's gotten nothing but worse. And then you think about the safety issues and, you know, big crashes. I mean, they're happening in all kinds of different places across the country. It's all because of lack of infrastructure investment. And like,
yeah, we are fingernailed. Metro is a fingernail of the country's infrastructure problems. The park service itself has a $12 billion gap in what it needs to be done.
Let me jump in. I mean, first of all, I was excited when Paul Wiederfeld was brought in. He came out of Maryland.
You knew him from Baltimore.
Yep, from Baltimore. He was in the, you know, our Department of Transportation, and over the years in a variety of positions. So, you know, he's really skilled. He's competent. He's knowledgeable. I thought it was a bold and maybe courageous move to shut down Metro for a day, not only for the practical importance of doing the safety checks, but sending a strong signal that certainly his leadership is he's committed to safety and reliability. You know, over the years, I mean, in Maryland, we were committed, and we made our financial commitment. And I do agree that with Jack Evans, that the federal government has to step up and make that investment in a system that moves 50% of the workforce on Capitol Hill back and forth to work. So
it's possible that the federal government and the people in the region are on different tracks. I couldn't help thinking this morning that before Paul Wiederfeld was appointed to this position, the emphasis for a search was focused on somebody who was a quote-unquote turnaround expert.
Whether it was a dispute, people wanted a turnaround expert, or they wanted somebody who simply knew something about transportation, about how wide the tracks were and how many cars you could run on them. But, you know, it would be great. People have complained to me, and I'll just say it for them, because I spoke for Jack Evans a moment ago. It would be nice if Secretary Fox, who keeps making these broadsides against Metro, would maybe spends more time, and I'm not aware of it. But this is a significant problem for the nation's capital, the metropolitan region. And he can throw incendiary bombs from up there, and he could demand that the federal appointees be better qualified, although the people on there, Harriet Tregoning, certainly knows a great deal about urban systems. It would be great if they would go all in on Metro rather than this flyover criticism that we seem to be getting from federal
government.
I just
get the impression that the transportation secretary is saying, turn around, schmurn around. Safety is what should be emphasized at this point.
Maybe we'd ask them about the metro, Memorial Bridge, too.
On to results in Maryland in the primaries that were held this past Tuesday. Aside from the presidential race, the highest profile contest was the rare Senate open seat, that of retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. As we know, Congressman Chris Van Hollen beat Congressman Donna Edwards. But in her concession speech, Edwards chastised the Maryland Democratic Party for not giving minorities and women a seat at the table and for sending what will be an all-male delegation into the November election. Christina, there's a similar debate going on in the presidential election. Hillary Clinton, quote-unquote, playing the woman card, according to one individual who shall remain nameless for the time being. Was this about race and gender, an all-boy network, or simply about these two candidates in Maryland?
You know, I can understand her argument, right? It could very well be an all-male delegation, but this is also a state that had Barbara Mikulski, who is one of the strongest female leaders in the nation, you know, let alone from Maryland. So it's not as if they haven't seen that. I took it as a symbol that she doesn't want to go away. You know, here's someone who does have a national presence. She is a bit of a progressive hero for her very first race, where she unseated an incumbent Democrat.
Al did win.
And she is well known among that kind of Bernie Sanders wing of the party, if you will. And so I would not be surprised to see her have some sort of role in politics if she just runs again, if she decides to run statewide. I mean, she's young. She's clearly ambitious. But it does highlight for me, it's not just about this particular race in Maryland. In Congress, what is the ascension path for Democrats right now? You've got the top leaders are all in their 70s. You know, I expect Nancy Pelosi will retire at some point, probably not next term, but it could be. But then what do? If you're an ambitious young Democrat, your options are really to look to other races. There's not a lot of incentive to stay in the House. You know, potentially you get there, it is something that you will hear from a lot of your colleagues because people want to ascend and they don't necessarily have a pathway.
By the way, if you have questions for Anthony Brown, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream there, join the conversation there, or shoot us a tweet at @kojoshow.
I may take up the entire program ranting. But no, I was at the Donna Edwards election night party at the Lanham at the IBEW headquarters. That's a cool building. They have a lot of nice things there.
Sure is. We do a lot of
functions really unhealthy
there.
Food, but there were a few apples and bananas. But when she was there, she came down, and when it was a long campaign for her. She got in March of last year, and it was an early night for her. She came down. She did speak to the crowd, and I thought it was one of the best concession speeches. She politely said she had spoken to Van Hollen, who did win, and then she just ripped the Democratic Party and said, when are African-American women going to have a seat at the table? When are women going to have a seat at the table? When are progressives going to have? And some people could dismiss it as a bitterness or whatever, but I do think it was kind of a clarion call of what she might do next. But the problem she had, Van Hollen, there was 100, 150 different statewide African-American leaders. Did you support somebody in this race?
Yeah, in this race, I did endorse Donna. And look, as I campaigned, I started this campaign 13 months ago. And as I knocked on doors, I knocked on 3,000 doors last summer alone. And Donna has a tremendous amount of support. I don't know what the numbers in the 4th Congressional District look like on Election Day for her, but on the doors at the Metro Centers and the barbershops, a lot of support. I think that Donna certainly stands for strong progressive ideals and values and is on the right side of the issues that our shared constituents stand for.
Patrick Murray, who heads the Maryland Democratic Party, responded by saying that going into the November election, the party wants to hear from Donna Edwards about how to be more inclusive and diverse. Is this something that the Democratic Party is struggling with?
Let me just say this. I mean, my concern is larger than the Maryland Democratic Party. I mean,
the Democratic Party as a whole.
I mean, but if you look across the nation, I mean, in the highest political offices in the land, governors and U.S. senators, these are statewide officials, there's a lack of diversity. There's a lack of diversity by both race and gender among the governors, the cadre, the core of governors, and the U.S. Senate. And I do think that, you know, I value diversity. I think Maryland is a state that could contribute to the diversity of both governors and U.S. senators. Chris Van Hollen's going to make an outstanding U.S. senator. There's no doubt about that. I'm looking forward to serving with him. But I think that, you know, both the U.S. Senate and the governor's offices around this country have to be diversified.
Well, and I want to finish my point about Donna because I said something nice saying what her speech was, her concession speech, and how aggressive it was. But I also want to say that she suffered because, in fact, of her inability over her period as the time being a member of Congress. She ran against Al Wynn and all of that, but she did not build relationships. You know, the Congressional Black Caucus didn't endorse her. They were neutral on this. Now, a lot of people didn't endorse Ike Leggett from Montgomery County, Rashern Baker from Prince George's County. More than 100, maybe close to 150 African-American officials, men and women, endorsed Chris Van Hollen because he has worked the fields and tried to build that relationship, which she almost proudly would not do. And so she was out. Even Heather Heather Mazur endorsed Chris Van Hollen. I mean, this was not some fluke by Chris Van Hollen to gather all this diverse support for himself. And I think that this is a lesson for her, Donna Edwards, going forward. She can't be on the same plane by herself.
On to the 4th Congressional District, which you won the primary, Anthony Brown, beating out former state's attorney and prosecutor Glenn Ivey. What do you think enabled your win in this race? Knocking on those 3,000 doors?
Well, that was a start. 3,000 doors, had, you know, a large grassroots organization, volunteers starting back in October on the phones, and I think we ended up, we tallied it up later this week. I think we made 100,000 calls.
You would have been governor if you'd done that a couple of years ago.
two different races, two different times.
Something of a comeback for you because, as Tom pointed out, you lost the gubernatorial race in 2014. What did you take from that defeat, and when did you know you wanted to get back in the game?
Well, like I used this paraphrase of LL Cool J last night, don't call this a comeback because I never left. And this was an opportunity when Senator Mikulski announced her retirement and Donna announced that she'd be running for the U.S. Senate for me to continue serving the people of Maryland. And I've always said, I said it when asked back in 2010 after the November reelection, are you going to run for governor? And at that time, I had not decided to do that. I always said, look, I'm going to put my experience, my skills, my talents to the highest and best use for the people of Maryland. And this provided an opportunity to do it.
I wonder, I mean, the structural issues here, it sort of gets back to our last discussion. But, you know, in California, we have a top two primary now. And in a state like Maryland, where you do obviously have some Republican districts, but overwhelming Democratic system, would that be something that would ever be considered by Maryland officials? And is that something that could be beneficial in opening this up, you know, not in your race specifically, but just in other races all
over? What's a top two primary? I've never heard that.
So the idea is that you pick a candidate and the top two people advance to November. So in California, where you have like heavily Democratic districts or even heavily Republican districts, you will often have two people of the same party on the general election ballot. So it will continue effectively a primary campaign, but it gives voters there a real choice, instead of, you know, a potentially easy win in the fall, but the person who has the numbers.
Yeah, I don't know how that would change the dynamics in Maryland. We don't have certainly there's no dearth of talent by gender or race. And at some point, the voters have to decide. And the winnowing process that we currently have by, you know, winning the primary and advancing to the general, I think gives voters an opportunity to make a decision.
How was turnout strong because of the presidential?
No, turnout was higher than it was in the last presidential election in Maryland, is my understanding.
Wow.
Well, you won. Congratulations. You beat Glenn Ivey.
Thank you. That's the first kind thing you've ever said to me on my show.
Glenn Ivey, you guys like 42% of the vote. He got like 37, and then is that enough for Ms. Pena?
I think she got 18.
18 or so. Well, it was a good, clear win for you. Did you talk to the other candidates that night? Did they speak to you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Delegate Pena Melnick, Jocelyn called me, and then Glenn called me. And let me tell you, I spent 9 days during this campaign, 8 early voting, 10 hours a day, 8 days in a row, and then 13 hours on election day, standing like 5 feet away from Glenn Ivey as we were both, you know, campaigning, electioneering at the polling place. He's a great guy. He's not
Lucifer in the flesh.
No, definitely not.
I love that phrase.
He's smart. He's confident. He's committed. He's pleasant. And the campaign was very much focused on the issues. We had 15 to 20 candidate forums. We didn't take shots at each other. We answered the questions on policy and governance and constituent services. We each pledged during the campaign and since to support one another, the winner. So last night, and you know, you can it's on Twitter, it's on Facebook. Last night, when I had my opportunity during the Democratic Party Unity rally to give remarks, I ended my remarks by calling up on stage all four of the five other candidates on stage, and it was.
But
Glenn.
isn't that kind of like at the the Oscars when the winner says, "Hey, you're all great," but then they're looking at you and they're trying to smile.
No, in fact,
that's what I'd feel like.
I mean, if you had attended, and I wouldn't have expected you to, our candidate forums, we acknowledged and commended one another during the forums. I remember acknowledging Glenn for the good work he had done as state's attorney in criminal justice reform and helping to drive down crime. I acknowledge Jocelyn Pena Melnick's work on a number of issues that she's taken up in the General Assembly. So we didn't wait till Oscar night to recognize the achievements.
Don your headphones, please, because Eddie in Prince George's County has a comment or question. Eddie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I just want to say congratulations to the Congressman Brown. I actually made a few calls during your campaign for governor, which unfortunately you had to pass that up. But I wanted to ask, what is the first thing on your agenda going to Congress?
Well, the first thing on his agenda is to go to Congress, right, because there's still an election coming in November. But I guess if he wins that election, Eddie would like to know what your first priority is.
Right. First of all, Eddie, thanks for your kind remarks and for helping out. But, you know, my top priority as a new member of Congress is going to be focusing on constituent services as I've traveled the district.
Something that Donna Edwards was actually criticized about. She resisted the criticism, but she was often criticized for not doing constituent service.
So, as I said, constituent services will be a top priority. And because what I've heard from voters is they just want government to work for them, to be responsive. They recognize that, you know, their challenges, their problems, their issues may not necessarily be resolved in a way most favorable to them, but that government ought to be responsive. It may be a small business owner that needs the Small Business Administration to be responsive. It may be, you know, a veteran, you know, trying to get a disability rating because they've just returned from Afghanistan or somewhere else, and for the VA to be responsive. So it's making sure that government, and not just the federal government, but state and local government is responsive. Because as when you talk to voters do not differentiate between federal, state, and local officials. They have an issue that they believe requires a response from government, and they're going to look to their member of Congress and expect results and expect for you to be responsive. So I understand that to be the case. I learned that when I was in the Maryland General Assembly, and so that's going to be my top priority.
Eddie, thank you very much for your call. In case you're just joining us, our guest is Anthony Brown, Maryland's former lieutenant governor who won the Democratic primary for Maryland's 4th Congressional District earlier this week. Also in studio with us is Christina Bellantoni, assistant managing editor for politics with the L.A. Times. She's our guest analyst. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers.
Well, let's talk money for a moment. Your campaign, near the end of the election, just before the primary, you took out a personal loan. I think it was about $400,000. You still owe about $400,000 to the Laborers Union for your gubernatorial race. Are you going to have time to do anything but fundraise? How are you going to handle those debts?
Retire those debts.
Yeah, look, as I've said over and over again, I will satisfy my obligations from the gubernatorial campaign. I'm committed to doing that. I've already begun to do that.
Is that right? I read 10% interest. Is that true?
No, I don't. I mean, the terms of that loan are. Right. I mean, they're filed with the State Board of Elections.
I read somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't.
I read
it was
$400,000 at 10%. I thought, my goodness,
no,
I want part of that.
No, 10%. I don't think that's accurate. But it's you know, that loan document is required to be publicly filed, and it's there. But I've begun satisfying that in a way that meets the terms with the laborers. So I don't anticipate that's going to be a problem. I'm not the first candidate.
Is that a campaign debt or a personal debt to laborers?
That is actually it's a campaign debt that's guaranteed by the candidate.
Okay.
Right. I'll fulfill that obligation.
Okay.
Now, if you win, are you going to live at home and commute into your work every day? Or are you going to get something in D.C.?
I think I'll have the distinction of being the member of Congress whose home is closest to the Capitol building. Now, I don't know. I maybe have to go measure it out.
Eleanor Holmes Norton might object to that.
Well, okay. I apologize.
The voting member of Congress.
Didn't want to open up that hornet's nest. I do support statehood.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
But then again, it could be Jamie Raskin because I think he lives in Silver Spring or Tacoma Park. But we're both going to be close. And no, I'm living at home. I'm going to commute. And when I moved down to the nation's capital almost a quarter century ago, I was working in Washington with a law firm, and I commuted on Metro, and I hope to take Metro to whatever the closest Metro stop is to the Capitol building. And
Capitol South.
Capitol South, okay.
Yes. Committees, have you thought about committees? And again, we don't want to – you have to win in November, so you've got to focus on that. But assume that you do win – Do you have a committee in mind? And Donna Edwards is on the space. I would love this. She's on the space and science committee,
and she told us, moon, yes.
And she said, "No, Mars."
Mars.
She said she would go on that. You don't return from the trip to Mars. And some people say, "Well, let her go," but other people said that would be a bad thing. But she wanted to go. Do you have something that kind of burns in your mind about what you want to be on?
You know, I think when I look at my experience and the things I've done in public office and in my life. I think there are some perhaps some natural fits. It could be, you know, the transportation and infrastructure, the work I've done as lieutenant governor on public-private partnerships, obviously Veterans Affairs.
Armed Services. It's tough to get on.
It's a tough one. Yeah, I imagine every committee is tough to get on, and at the end of the day, it won't, you know, I'll express my preference, but, you know, if it's anything like the Maryland General Assembly, suspect it is, it's a leadership decision.
Well, Van Hollen to the state, he could become speaker, and then he could appoint his colleague to whatever you wanted.
I'm not making any assumptions about November. You'll be up You'll be up against Republican George McDermott. What will you focus on between now and the election?
Sure. So, and I'm glad that you brought us back to where we are today, which is with a general election in front of us. And you know, you take nothing for chance, and we're going to run a robust campaign that will have all the essential components, a field campaign. You know, we'll communicate, we'll reach out and not take for granted any voter in Anne Arundel County and Prince George's County. So I've asked my volunteers to take a little bit of time and spend with their families because, as I said, they've made a lot of calls, did a lot of door knocking and other visibility events. So we'll regroup, we'll count the beans and the bullets, we'll redistribute and as necessary, and we'll pick it up real soon and run a strong general election campaign.
Do you know anything about George McDermott as a candidate? You know him at all?
I've met him at two candidate forums. He seems to be focused on the inefficiency and dysfunction and of the court system. And other than that, I know he's run before. He's run actually, I understand, as a Democrat. I don't know if this is the first time he's running as a Republican. But we'll take him seriously and we'll, you know, dedicate the time, attention, and resources to make sure we win this one.
We got a tweet from Julio who says, Anthony Brown says he values diversity, but he didn't want to join the legislative black caucus upon his election to the House of Delegates.
Look, first of all, is it Julio?
Julio yes.
Ought to send me his email address, and I'll send him a 8x10 photo from every one of the 7 or 8 years when I was in the Maryland General Assembly, because we take an annual photo of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm not the Congressional, I apologize, the Maryland Legislative Black Caucus. And not only was I a member, but a very active member. So I look forward to joining the CBC and being very active in the work of both the foundation and the issues that are important to its members.
Julio, he says you don't know what the heck you're talking about. Here's Mike in Alexandria, Virginia. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Put on your headphones, all. Mike, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. I wanted to ask Mr. Brown if he's planning to try to get on the Veteran Affairs Committee, being, you know, that he is a veteran, and what he's going to do to try to reach some oversight for that specifically with regards to the VA and the various problems they have about getting services to our
veterans. Struggling VA, the Veterans Affairs.
Sure, and, you know, and as I mentioned before, I mean, with my experience in the military and a veteran who's actually used the VA hospital system and has received benefits through the VA, I think that's certainly a committee that would make sense. Whether I'm on the committee or not, I will focus on veterans issues. And I spent some time back in 2008 co-chairing the Obama-Biden Veterans Transition Committee. And there are a number of things that strike me, not only, you know, ensuring that you've got good leadership, but they continue to operate on this legacy platform, technology platform, which hinders this department considerably, because it really is it's a benefits department. And whether it's health services or disability benefits or the other programs and services, In this day and age, you've got to have a technology system that supports it, and particularly with the increase in volume of veterans in the last decade. So I'll focus on it. I'll certainly sit down with the leadership at the VA, and there'll be I'm sure there's going to be some turnover with the new administration, and make sure the good leadership, good technology in place to get and funding to get the job done.
Let's come back to the state of Maryland and ask about the governor's race. You lost.
You mean the one that's coming up in 2018?
I'm looking ahead, not back. Larry Hogan, some of the polling shows he's got like 60% approval rating, a Republican in the very Democratic blue state, Maryland. He's talked a little about running for reelection. How do you see this party? Do you need to find to answer Donna Edwards' questions? Do you need to cast a wide net? Who's going to be running for governor? Maybe, Rashern Baker might run. I think there's some other people, the congressman from the 6th District. He's thinking about it, people are saying. Where do you see your role, assuming again that you win in November and don't have an ugly surprise? What does the party need to do now to defeat Larry Hogan? I assume you think he should be defeated for reelection.
Yeah, first, let me start by saying thank you to Governor Hogan. I tried to return his call. He called me to congratulate me for the victory. And you may recall when he was sworn in or just before that, I mean, I was in Annapolis. I introduced him to lawmakers and wished him well. And I truly meant that because I want any governor to be successful so that the state of Maryland can be successful. But you're right, Tom, I'm not really looking forward to a second term of Governor Hogan. But I also caution my Democratic colleagues that we should not assume that Larry Hogan is going to be a one-term a governor just because Bob Ehrlich was. And as you mentioned, he's highly favored among Marylanders, including young Marylanders, including African Americans in Maryland. So, we've got our work cut out for us. And that starts with party building. I said last night at the Unity event that the rally itself is really more symbolic. The work is what we do around the state as a party to build our infrastructure, to mobilize, to excite people about our platform and our values. And that's what we're going to have to do regardless of who the candidate is.
Do you have a candidate in mind for yourself at this point? I know it's early.
I'm declaring that I am not running for governor in 2018.
Anthony Brown, he is Maryland's former lieutenant governor. He won the Democratic primary for Maryland's 4th congressional district earlier this week. Anthony Brown, thank you very much for joining us. Once again, congratulations and good luck in November.
Thank you, and thanks to both of you as well. Take care.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Our guest analyst today is Christina Bellantoni, assistant managing editor for politics with the Los Angeles Times. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Paul Strauss. He's a shadow senator for the District of Columbia. In the meantime, Christina, we got an email from Ed in Bethesda who says, one of your panelists asked about having a top two primary to, as she put it, give the voters a real choice in November. First off, that system has produced elections with two Republican candidates in districts or states that are heavily Democratic because a long list of candidates split the Democratic vote. Second, if the point is to give more voters a say in who wins the election, why not open up the primary elections instead? The largest number of voters are unaffiliated. Why do we keep them out of the process in the primaries?
Well, not every state does keep them out of the process in the primaries, but many states are different. Maryland, yeah. So in California, if you are a declined to state voter, you can vote in the Democratic primary and not the Republican one for president. But the way that we do it, and there are competing schools of thoughts. Steve Israel, retiring congressman from New York, former DCCC chairman, hates them. He has been on the record of talking about, this is just, it's a system where you could have that, there you can have surprises. But in places where voters haven't been presented with real choices, particularly against incumbents who are, with that party that is favored in that district, it does give them newer options. There are definitely competing arguments about it. I think that they provide a lot of opportunity for voters to get more excited about a primary, but then also the people that don't show up in a primary will have a say in a general election.
I think there's some merit to saying that the person who wins should have 50%, so that if you run in the race, of course you have eight or non-candidates, it's not likely to get 50%. But it may be that if you don't get 50%, the top two candidates have a runoff. It costs more, something like that, to get more people involved. But the bottom line is, just as you say, is that so many people could vote but do not vote.
Okay, on to some matters having to do with the District of Columbia. The former campaign chauffeur for former Mayor Vincent Gray, Mark Long, is going to go before a judge to make the argument that he wants to throw out his plea deal because he says the punishment is uneven, pointing, of course, to the fact that the individual who financed the $653,000 shadow campaign, Jeffrey Thompson, is facing no more than 6 months in prison, while Mark Long, the former chauffeur of Vincent Gray, is looking at 5 years because he apparently knew that his salary was being paid, so to speak, under the table, that it was not being listed in campaign records. And there are those people who will say, well, you know, Vincent Gray was not prosecuted at all. Jeffrey Thompson, who financed the campaign, is only getting 6 months, and now all of these small-time people are facing more time in prison.
I'm trying to quote, I think, Jimmy Carter, "Life is not fair." Did he say that?
Yes, life is unfair.
He said that to a welfare recipient. I can't remember what he said. Something terrible he said. But I will say it in this case. I'm not a lawyer, he was expected to be a person to testify against the mayor about the mayor's goings around town and walking into his campaign office with $100,000 in VIT checks and money orders, which the mayor acknowledged he did. He thought it was real money. So I don't know what the legal issue there is. We have in the next few weeks, we're going to have a lot of these cases left over from the shadow campaign resolved. And the biggest one, though, is Jeffrey Thompson will be in court, scheduled to be in court on June the 10th, which is 4 days before the next before the primary. And that means in a couple of days before June 10th, we'll get even more documents from the prosecutors about what Jeffrey Thompson did. It could be more embarrassment for Gray, or it could be another reason for him to stand up and say the prosecutors are trying to axe me a second time. Don't let them do it. But I think the driver is a minor player in this. And maybe I think a judge will probably not give him 5 years or anything close to it, but maybe he wants to make sure a judge doesn't do that.
The D.C. Children and Youth Investment Trust Corporation has as its responsibility helping more than 70 after-school and other programs to help at-risk youth to control gang violence in the nation's capital. That's a quote from a report in the Washington Post. But it seems that there are people who look at it and saw it as a piggy bank for themselves, and now it's in piggy bankruptcy, so to speak. It cannot support the at-risk children that it's supposed to help. It's going out of business. What happens to these kids?
Not soon enough. This is the trust. It was a grand idea of Mayor Tony Williams back in 1999 that you put this Children and Youth Investment Trust together, and then people they'll collect monies and they'll disperse monies to organizations, willing organizations that can do better at getting services for young people. And Harry Thomas was able to steal $350,000 from them. The people that have run it have used credit cards for their own personal business. I do hope the Inspector General, I actually talked to the U.S. Attorney's Office this morning because they never answered these questions, but I said, is the U.S. Attorney going to be investigating this? Millions, they're closing down because Marie Johns, who's the head of it, who has a very good reputation, says we simply don't have the money to give. They're going to give out grants to the end of the year, but this is a horrific organization with a horrific track record, and I hope there's some legal inquiry into what happened.
Christine, Representative Andy Harris won his party's primary in Maryland's 1st Congressional District. I mentioned that because he's known for his interest in D.C.'s local politics, in particular taking on D.C.'s marijuana legalization. Local activists tried to defeat him in this race, but he won by a landslide nonetheless, 79% of the votes cast in that district. He rode in on the Tea Party wave himself when he was first elected in 2010. How are Tea Party candidates faring in general these days?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, especially incumbency is so powerful. You know, if you serve a term or two, people just suddenly forget even where you came from and you've got the experience and they check the box next to you. He is a really interesting character, and we followed him very closely at Roll Call just because he was constantly inserting himself in issues that affected Washington and didn't necessarily speak to what he was doing as a member of Congress. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me. He has plenty of money. He has institutional support. He's somebody that he's in some ways, I don't necessarily want to make the comparison of him to Trump, but no matter what he did, it never seemed to hurt him back home.
Even though District of Columbia activists have been active in trying to get him out
not
of office,
fans, yeah.
It's
well,
not
no, he's
succeeding.
In the gerrymandered districts right. of Maryland. That's why the real issue across cutting across all these elections in every state is the gerrymandered Congress that we have, which is kept the incumbents in. What is it, 92% of incumbents yes. or something like that win? But if you just look at the 4th district where Donna Edwards represents and how it squirrels all around up and down the eastern part of the state, and you look at the 8th district, which I think goes all the way up to the Pennsylvania line, even though it's principally a suburban Washington County, the redistricting of the Congress of the United States is a national disgrace the way it is
and
now.
And don't forget, President Obama, in his State of the Union, tucked that little mention in, saying he would like to see these independent commissions, similar to what they did in California and some other states, start to pick lines instead because the process is just so broken. And I don't think anything's happened since then, but he actually
Nothing.
Amended what was in his prepared remarks and gave like a little even more off the cuff on that. So you never know. Next
the Census Bureau has the Census Bureau has the details from which you could draw reasonable districts.
Joining us now by phone is Paul Strauss. He is a shadow senator for the District of Columbia. He is a Democrat. Paul Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
Mayor Muriel Bowser and district leaders are calling for a constitutional convention for statehood for the District of Columbia. This wouldn't be the first time this has happened, but they're also talking about changing the district's license plates so that they would read "End taxation without representation." I think I'm going to have to get new reading glasses to see that because that's a lot to put on a license plate. But what's your view of what's going on, and do you think this time around it's going to be any different?
D.C. residents want statehood. They've always wanted statehood, and we're going to use this convention and the subsequent vote in November to remind the rest of the United States that we both want and deserve statehood.
Who's going to pay for the convention?
The convention is really going to be more of a public hearing process. There's actually a vehicle called the New Columbia Statehood Commission that is going to take public testimony, invite public participation, and then approve a draft constitution, which will then go to the council, who can enact
I thought the Congress, Paul, I thought the Congress had passed some rider that said the city government couldn't spend any money for statehood. Did they do that and that went away?
We have been able to make that go away. There is still a prohibition on the use of federal funds. But remember, we have budget autonomy now.
So when it comes to
the use of our local funds, we believe we have the authority to do it unless Congress acts to contravene what we do. So budget autonomy wasn't pure freedom, but what it means is that if the Congress wants to use its plenary power over D.C., they have to get their act together and overrule us.
Draft the Constitution and Congress does essentially what it did back in 1983, just vote against allowing the district to become the state of New Columbia?
Well, look, we understand that all states require the approval of Congress, but this is an opportunity to engage so many new residents for whom the fight for statehood isn't quite as personal yet. You know, the last time we voted, the last time we had a constitutional convention, it was over 30 years ago. The mayor was in the fifth grade. I was a freshman in college. And it is time to freshen up the Constitution because the original one had a few things in there that just no longer make sense today. We want a Constitution that will more closely conform to the institutions of government that help the district function now and will be not an obstacle to statehood or a distraction, but a vehicle for advancing the issue and moving it forward.
If you have questions or comments for Paul Strauss, give us a call, 800-433-8850, or go to our live video stream at kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, I've studied this for a long time, and
You used to have to do this at roll call, right?
Yeah, and even before that, you know, and you had a moment where you had a Democratic president, a Democratic Congress, and a lot of support for this, and it didn't happen. And so I just wonder, you know, no matter what happens, you're going to have a Republican House, you know, come January. This doesn't seem to have legs, and I just wonder, you know, why now? And also, I mean, the idea of giving some of D.C. back to Maryland.
That's not going to happen.
Virginia. I know it won't happen.
I'm sorry.
But this is the counter argument. So you sort of see people that are just totally facing off and have no wiggle room.
Let's put the dagger in the idea of retrocession to Maryland. It's not that people in the district might or might not want it. It's that the people of Maryland, I'm telling you, the Republicans in that state are not going to want 670,000 new citizens, all of whom are Democrats and will control the state party. The Democrats who are trying to move up Van Hollen, those guys don't want the district as part of their state. That's never going to happen, whether the D.C. wants it or not.
Paul Strauss, a survey in Maryland shows that 44% don't want their state to annex the district.
Well, and I bet you'd see similar numbers in D.C. Maryland doesn't want us back. We don't want to go. We don't want to trade the dome of the capital of the United States for the dome of Annapolis. The state line that has separated Maryland and the district since 1790 is one of the oldest state borders in the United States. So it is a non-starter. And while I understand the gerrymandered districts make a Republican House likely, if it's one thing I've learned about this election cycle, is that anybody who's predicting anything is going to be surprised.
But Chris, let's go back to her original question that I jumped all over. But why now? What do you think? Where is the pathway to victory that you see, other than just people voting for statehood in the district again is a foregone conclusion?
Well, we think that we're going to have a new president, we think we're going to have a lot of new senators, and we think we are going to have a lot of new members in the House, and we want to take advantage of this momentum, this national election, to rededicate ourselves to this effort. And we need to make sure that structurally we as the district are ready to become a state. So that means having a state constitution that will work as opposed to one that is essentially a historical document at this point, making sure that the citizens are engaged in using this advisory referendum to build support inside the district and around the country.
Have you had any conversations with Hillary Clinton about this presently or in the past?
Secretary Clinton, I'm told through her campaign liaisons, the political directors, the people who are responsible for reaching out to me and other superdelegates, that she supports statehood. We know that Senator Sanders is a co-sponsor and a supporter, and we expect it to be in the Democratic Party platform of this convention. And frankly, we've had success in getting it into the party platforms of other states. We have outreach in Iowa. We have efforts underway in Nevada, some of the early caucus states where citizens of their own from that state have embraced D.C. statehood as an issue of simple justice and fairness.
Well, you know, as a citizen of the city, I would obviously like to have the two senators and a fully voting member of the House. But I still can't get over, you would have been much farther down the road if you had taken Congressman Tom Davis of Virginia's proposal to do the pairing with Utah, and he said if this city had not reared up like a donkey and said no, you would have had a voting member of the House for these last few years who could have been pursuing the whole idea of statehood, because we would have paired with a new vote for Utah, which is essentially Republican. Is this another false start for statehood?
No, I think what we've learned from that example is that the opponents of D.C. right are going to fight us just as hard when we seek partial voting rights as when we seek full statehood.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Frankly, having Delegate Norton being able to vote on the House floor as well as Committee of the Whole or other committees would have been helpful, but it doesn't get us what we really need, which is representation in both chambers of Congress. The district is handicapped by the Senate in so many ways. Right now, we have three D.C. Superior Court judges that aren't getting confirmed, not because of any opposition or problems, but because the Senate isn't doing its job in confirming judges. Frankly, they should have no business doing it. When Metro has meetings on public safety, I've tried to go to those meetings with other senators. Most of those stops are in my district. They're not letting me participate. These are public safety safety issues. It's not necessarily partisan politics. D.C. needs representation in the Senate. D.C. needs the autonomy that comes with statehood. It's what we deserve. It's what we're seeking. And one day we're going to get it. A lot of people never thought we'd see legal marijuana. A lot of people never thought we'd see marriage equality. We have made great strides on a lot of human rights and equal justice and fundamental fairness issues.
Let me interrupt you because we're going to take a call. I just want to say one of the reasons the city leaders didn't want to do that Utah compromise is because there was a rider on there that would hurt the cities or gotten rid of the city's gun laws. So I know that was part of the issue. I don't want people to yell at me later today.
Here's Ab Jordan.
Absolutely.
Here's Ab Jordan. Absalom Jordan Jr. is on the phone.
Nice calm presence added to the show.
Ab, what do you have to say to Paul Strauss?
Paul, I'm adamantly opposed to what's being proposed for several reasons. First of all, as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, I realized that it was a process that we went through where citizens, first of all, determined that we wanted to have a Constitutional Convention. And then we had the election of delegates from each ward. The proposal that you have right now at this point is going to rely upon a commission to have hearings, and that commission is not representative of all wards. That's the first thing. But, Paul, the other problem I've got is you're saying now we've got new people in the city that need to buy into it. And my concern is from a perspective of a city that was predominantly black to one now that's less black. And the question for me is what racial implications that has. You say that there are areas that need to be changed until you spell those out. Because the Constitution that we wrote was quite progressive. And I don't know why we look at it now and say that it doesn't reflect the conditions or the needs of the people today. And if you can't offer specifics in terms of those areas.
In other words, Paul, the only difference between then and now is that there are more white people in the city.
Right.
I don't think so. The biggest difference we have is that the institutions of the home rule government that were just a few years old back then are now more established. So people are more used to the institutions of government. We have a council that we've had now for almost 30 years as opposed to 3 years. We now have an elected attorney general. We now have a variety of structures, advisory neighborhood commission, so forth. We do not want the statehood process to be disruptive to the current functioning of government. What we want to do is get Congress out of our business, come up with a document that will help get the citizens of D.C. the sovereignty they deserve, and then that Constitution has an amendment process. So once we no longer need Congress's approval to change our charter, we can continue to rewrite and amend that Constitution.
Who's going to pick the commission?
We only have about 30 seconds left. Go ahead, please.
Who's going to pick the commission very quickly?
The commission is already existing by statute. It is the mayor, the council chairman, and the three members of the shadow congressional delegation or the statehood delegation, as we're sometimes
called. That includes you.
It does.
Paul Strauss, he is shadow senator for the District of Columbia. He's a Democrat. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom, another technical issue is that granting the district statehood, the federal government would still need a district, not part of any state, from which to conduct its business.
That could be a phone booth. It doesn't have to be. If you know what a phone booth is, people look it up.
It could be
the federal land around the Congress and the White House.
And, of course, you would have a gun store that could sell guns.
A gun store, yes. I'm all for the gun store.
Tom Sherwood, he's our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Christina Bellantoni is assistant managing editor for politics with the L.A. Times. That's it for the show today. But remember, we've got lots more for you online. Explore our archives at kojoshow.org. If you missed yesterday's show, go back and check it out. We talked about the momentum behind the Black Lives Matter movement. And then we heard from three local poets to close out National Poetry Month. Remember, too, that you can listen on your schedule by streaming the show online or on your favorite podcast app. However you listen, have a great weekend. Be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking about the high school in Virginia that's become the latest battleground in the national debate around transgender rights and bathrooms. Also, after more delays and more safety incidents, the Federal Transportation Secretary shakes up the Metro Board. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Don't WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kodjo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.